Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cybersecurity for All podcast, a podcast all about cybersecurity from ApeTech. I'm your host, Alex, and today I have a very special treat. My second guest, John Lunn, is coming to you all the way from the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. He is an expert and has been in the cloud space for a very long time. He specifically specializes in Azure. And today I had the pleasure of interviewing him, getting to know his background a little bit more. And he's going to be talking about his perspective of the cloud and cybersecurity. And then he's just going to bless us with a wealth of information and just give us a ton of resources that I think you're going to find very valuable. So stick around and listen to this interview, and I hope you enjoy it. As always, you can find me at apetech.me/social. That's where you'll get the links to everything and find out everything that I'm working on. This podcast is just one of many things. I also have a TikTok. You can find me there at ApeTechDA. And if you want to reach out to me the quickest way, I'm very active on Twitter at ApeTechDA. Feel free to send me a message there, and I'd be more than happy to get back to you. All right. Well, without further ado, let's jump into today's interview. And again, please make sure you share this with your friends and family. This was a great, great interview. I had a great time doing it, and I think you're going to really enjoy it. So make sure you share with everybody you know, and let me know if you have any comments or questions. I'd be more than happy to get those addressed. All right, let's jump into it.
Cool.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Cybersecurity for All podcast by ApeTech. I have a very special guest with me today. I have a close friend of mine, Johnny Lunn, and he's from the other side of the pond, and we've been friends for a while now on Twitter. Haven't actually met, but I brought him on. He's in the cloud space, specifically within Azure and all the Microsoft goodness there. And so we're going to be talking about cybersecurity, we're going to be talking about cloud, and we're going to be talking about a few other things that I think you're going to find interesting. So with that said, I'll give it over to John so he can give us a little bit more of a detailed introduction and tell us about your life, what's going on, what are you currently working on, and just take it away, John.
Yeah, how you doing, Alex? Thanks for having me on your show. How's things? You good?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. It's been a crazy month. I know we had a conversation about a month ago, a little over a month. And yeah, my life, I can't wait to tell you all about it in a bit. But
we'll dig into it. No, so flipped. I mean, I've been slowly fighting my way through the raft of work that's going on at the minute. So yeah, like I say, thanks for having me on, Alex. So I guess, my name is John Lunn. As you said, I'm based over in the UK. So a little country called Wales, which is attached to the side of England, for those that want to find it on a map. So yeah, I've been working in the cloud space, predominantly Microsoft stack, since the dawn of my career, I guess. So for a number of years now, but I think specifically in terms of cloud, I've been focused on Azure for a good 4 to 5 years, but working with it for probably about a decade now, I guess. I mean, my day job is I'm a technical architect. I work for a company called BT Enterprise over in the UK. So I help BT's customers try and, you know, fight their way through the various aspects of cloud and cloud technologies and how to adopt the cloud, how to innovate in the cloud and transition and move workloads or re-architect workloads. So it's a really great space to be working in at the moment, you know, especially from a Microsoft viewpoint, because, you know, as we all know, tech is evolving hugely at the moment and has been for a number of years. So I think it's a good place to be working right now. You know, there's lots to learn, lots of exciting, cool, funky new technologies to get into. And yeah, so I'm just having fun working with my customers, doing lots of things with the cloud at the minute.
That's awesome. Yeah. One of my favorite things about the cloud and even within the world of cybersecurity and just technology in general, it's always evolving, right? So there's always something new to learn, something, a new skill to acquire. There's definitely no shortage of getting bored with, like, it's not like accounting where it's the same thing day in, day out. In our field, we can definitely stretch our legs a little bit and even stretch our capabilities quite a bit.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, so I wanted to jump in, maybe like an origin story, right? Like you said, you've been doing this for about 10 years. What got you interested? How did you first discover the cloud? Like, what was your thought process there with making a transition? Maybe you can tell us what you were doing before, prior to 10 years ago, and how you kind of jumped in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's like everybody at the moment. We've all got our own journeys into, you know, how we find ourselves where we are at this particular point in our careers. And I think for me, I never started off in tech. You know, my first position was working a commercial job where I was, you know, raising contracts and quotations for various bits and pieces. I actually worked for a forklift and excavator manufacturing company. So I wasn't involved in tech at that stage, you know, when I came out of college and got my first job. I never did the whole university thing. I kind of went straight out of college. I mean, in the UK, college is just before you go to university. So, you know, after coming out of that, probably about 17, 18, moved into my first job. And it was purely there, you know, to kind of pay the bills and you know, get a bit of pocket money so I could go out and do things. And actually, I did performing arts in college, so I was into music and recording techniques and all that kind of thing.
So I think your background, eh?
So I think like, when I came out of college, well, I came out, and of course, I was going to be an internationally famous rock star. That was my plan A, you know, of course. And I got a job, and in the real world, I, you know, in order to fund my desire to become this rich famous rock star, I needed to earn some money. So I started off, like I say, not in a non-tech role. And as the years went by, I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. You know, I wanted to be this rock star, but, you know, that you know, clearly wasn't happening, you know, for me at that stage of my life. So I kind of transitioned. I was always interested as a kid. I was always tinkering with, you know, I had a Commodore 64. I was playing about with basic coding, but it was all hobby, yeah? And by the kind of late 90s, I was one of those kids that was dabbling with HTML and Dreamweaver and Flash, I think, had just been launched. So I remember tinkering around with all of those kind of technologies and putting little websites together for my friends and bands and, you know, music websites. And I remember when, showing my age now, but when MySpace got launched, and it was the place to be if you're in a band. So I kind of dabbled in the area purely because of my hobbies at the time and the way I was going. So after a while and realizing that I actually needed to earn some money, I ended up working for a company, like I say, in a commercial capacity, just, you know, doing bits and pieces around the actual products that they made and manufactured and sold. And I was that kid in the office that kind of knew how to fix a paper jam. I knew how to change a toner cartridge without spilling it all over myself, and, you know, kind of, you know, knew how to kind of make a computer do something when it was broken, basically. And after a few years of doing that, I realized, actually, you know, it's not a bad career. I think I might want to delve into this world of tech. So this was probably around the early 2000s, where I basically said to my manager at the time, look, I'm going to start doing, there's a thing in the UK called Open University, which is, you know, to get your degree qualification, you can do it as a remote or a mature student. So I signed up to start doing a computer science degree, effectively. And after about 6 months of doing that, I kind of asked the company that I was working for, look, is there any chance I can have a job working in the IT department? And they said, yeah, no problem, John. So I kind of got thrown in at the deep end. So I moved straight into an IT department. And at the time, if you picture the kind of company, it's a relatively small company. It probably had about 500 staff, but it had offices globally. So, you know, we were based in South Wales, was the head office. And we had offices out in Australia, in China, and out in the US as well. And basically, we were a small IT team. And it was, like I say, I mean, I've spoken with other people about this, but in that kind of environment with a relatively small IT team, it is all hands on deck. If it's got a plug on it, it's IT's responsibility to fix it and maintain it if it breaks, that kind of thing. So literally, I mean, it was a baptism of fire, but I look back in hindsight, and that was really where I cut my teeth in the IT industry, because I got to play, I say play, I got to work with, but effectively I was learning all sorts about, you know, the core compute, so networking, storage, compute, I remember, you know, telephony, and really from, and even laying fiber cables and terminating fiber and laying networks, you know, across the manufacturing facilities. So I really had my hand in anything and everything at the time. So I was very much one of those generalists, jack of all trades, whatever you want to call it. But like I said, I look back. Go on, sorry.
I recently, jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah. Right?
Still better than a master of one.
Well, you know, it's one of these, it's one of those things that I think everybody's got their own opinion of that. Yeah. And I think the jack of all trades to one person is the, you know, to somebody else is, you know, could be the utopia, the you know, my God, they know everything about everything. And it's like, look, we're in an industry now where we just need to accept that where we are today, nobody is going to know everything about everything. You know, it's just simply not possible. And I guess that I kind of worked in that capacity for probably around about 6 or 7 years. And then I got the itch to kind of think, well, I'm working for a single company. I've done my best. I've done project work. I've, you know, worked with all the Microsoft technologies. Where can I go? Where can I take my career? So I guess around about 10 years ago now, I decided to take the leap of faith. And I jumped from that job into a position of a technical consultant. And when we say, you know, jack of all trades, master of none, effectively, I focused at that time on unified comms. So I'd done a lot with telephony and messaging. So I kind of got a job as a unified comms consultant. So I was dealing with exchange migrations. And it wasn't long until, you know, sort of, I think it was coming, Microsoft had a product called BPOS, which was their original kind of cloud SaaS-based messaging and office suite environment. It was before they then rebranded that to 365. And that would have been, yeah, probably about 10, 11 years ago now, I'd imagine. And yeah, so I guess...
My first hearing about it was probably around 2014, 2013 timeframe.
If
memory recalls correctly. But that's the first time I ever heard about it.
Yeah, I think I can't remember the dates, but I probably would have thought it was around about the 2010, 2011. That's when I started working with it in Anger. It was just as it transitioned over to 365. So I may have my years wrong, but it's around about that sort of time. And that was, if you like, that was my first introduction to this thing called cloud, because from a messaging point of view, we're always dealing with, message flow, message relay, that kind of stuff. And it goes through, you know, spam filters and message hygiene filters and things like that. And of course, at that stage, there were companies like Mimecast and Barracuda were doing a lot of that web filtering and message hygiene kind of functionality. They were kind of the two main players back then. And I know Mimecast is still going strong today. And they were, if you like, SaaS, software as a service offerings. They were effectively, you could get on-premise versions, but they were, that was about the age where these cloud hosted solutions came to be, you know, and it was like, oh, okay, I get it now that we can kind of filter mail flow through these services and have it come back to your on-prem environment. And then, of course, the more and more businesses wanted to start to move to this new thing called Office 365 back then. So I kind of went with the flow, and I was doing a lot of transitions over to 365 from an Exchange point of view. And around about that time then, again, I remember this thing called Azure got launched. And at the time, it wasn't anything like it looked like it does today. You know, of course,
I just love the way you say Azure, though. I love it.
Azure.
Azure all day long.
Azure. It's going to be, well, I fluctuate between the American way and the British way. It's Azure in the UK.
Your guys' way of pronouncing words is a million times better than all the American stuff we have.
Well, we've got extra letters in our words half the time, haven't we, over here? So,
sometimes with the Z and the S, right? Sometimes they get as organization. I know in Australia it's like they spell organization, well, not with the Z at the end, but
with an S. Organization, organization. It's S's and Z's, isn't it? But and that was it. I think I got involved with a lot of that, so I kind of built up doing that kind of role again for about 4 or 5 years, and the later part of that then, it was lots of businesses were now starting to transition to 365, and it was mainly Exchange migrations. And it got to the stage where, you know, if you've done any Exchange migrations, you'll know that there's this thing called a hybrid server that would get stood up, and effectively it's like a management point and a message relay service that kind of stays on-prem. And it was a little bit of a bugbear for a while, because, you know, businesses were looking to move to 365 to kind of remove that kind of infrastructure on-prem. I remember at the time when we talk about security around Exchange, you know, the options we had were to spin up some kind of ADFS, so Federation services, and that had a massive footprint. You know, we were talking about having to spin 4 VMs up, you know, proxy servers, internal servers.
I worked in Exchange for about a year at Boeing, managing email for 150,000 employees, and we have 3 data centers that we would just have redundant. Everything duplicated, and it was crazy, crazy.
No, time. But that's how it was. I remember Exchange. I mean, after 2003, when it went to 2007, you had the whole database availability group thing started up, and we could start to replicate databases across different clusters.
Oh, the DAGs,
the DAGs,
nightmares.
well, you know, this is where you know you learn your craft doing these things. You know,
yeah,
and of course. You know, it's a case of, well, hang on a minute. Companies were looking to remove all this infrastructure only to replace it now with a big cluster of ADFS servers and an Exchange hybrid server and a DirSync server, which is AD Connect now, you know, to synchronize those user accounts to 365 or Azure AD. And so it became a little bit strange because we were speaking to customers about doing this, but all of a sudden, yeah, we're going to remove your 4-node cluster of your Exchange servers. We're going to replace it with 5 servers to manage your identity authorization and, you know, your synchronization. And it was just a bit of a strange place to be. So we started to see then more and more customers were happy to start to put these VMs, these servers, into Azure. There we go. I'll say it the proper way, I suppose.
No, I'm telling you, I Azure. Love listening to you say Azure.
Azure. Azure. So that was probably my first little dabble into the world of Azure. Azure. You got me questioning myself how I say it.
You do you. I love the way your sounds. It sounds way better.
So I think we, you know, back then, what am I probably thinking now? This is probably around 2013, 2014, I guess. We were starting to see lots of customers now happy to start placing these servers into Azure. And it was at that stage where I thought, okay, I get this. I'm starting to see that this Azure thing, it can kind of push me back to my traditional generalist roots because I can start to think about virtualization and spinning up VMs and networking and configuring storage. And I thought, maybe this is a place I need to be. So, I mean, anyway, it was more than just messaging. I was dealing with OCS, Link, Skype for Business, migrations into Teams. And I think when it went over to Teams, I got a little bit disillusioned because I thought, well, we're going completely cloud-based now. And as a consultant, we're now getting to the nitty-gritty of actually the application level and how the application works rather than the underlying infrastructure, which is the TIN and the storage and the networking. So I was finding myself learning more and more about the application layer. But I was, like I said, I was becoming a little bit disillusioned. So I turned my gaze over to Azure. And I thought, well, Azure gives me that ability now. I'm not just concentrating on spinning up a hybrid server or something to support my unified comms environment. Actually, I can start speaking to customers about shifting other workloads into this new, you know, at the time it was probably about 4 or 5 years old, but relatively new to me in terms of capabilities outside of just spinning VMs up. So that's when I kind of decided, right, I'm going to focus a bit more now on this platform. And it was seen back then as a traditional data center to some extent. And then, of course, over the last 5, 6, 7 years, we know that Azure has just been flooded with so much innovation, with feature sets, with, you know, the ability to develop your on-cloud type solutions. And it's kind of, that's what's led me up to today. So for the last 4 years, I've really been working with customers doing exactly that. So transitioning from that traditional data center approach into Azure, and, you know, modernizing applications, you know, changing over from that traditional IaaS type principled way of deploying things into more platform as a service and software as a service offerings. And with that has come a whole wealth of learning and security being one of the predominant ones, I think, over that time. I mean, especially if you've worked with Microsoft, they kind of you kind of become a pseudo security consultant because you kind of have to be, because all the security controls and security elements are kind of baked into the product sets and baked into the licensing SKUs that you buy with 365 and things like that. So yeah, I mean, that was a potted history of how I've come to be today. So happy to take that off in whatever direction you like.
Yeah, no, this is great. I do have a couple of like follow-up questions with what we just spoke here. So sounds to me, just based on what I'm hearing, you kind of got your foot in through the door through that unified communications world, right? Primarily dominated by Microsoft technologies. Is that why you kept going with Microsoft technologies when you're looking at even at the cloud? Or have you ever considered, or did you ever consider like Amazon's offerings or Google's offerings? Or what was your thought process with putting your chips into the Microsoft Azure bucket?
Yeah, I mean, and that's a really good question. Do you know what? And this is the question now where I'll probably I'll segregate your audience, your listening audience now, because now I think it's very much one of those things.
I'm generally curious, yeah.
Yeah, and it is, and I am very curious, to be honest, because I have very much I don't think I'm a Microsoft fanboy. At least, you know, that's how I feel. I'm not a Microsoft fanboy because I've dealt with plenty of other vendors over the years in terms of, you know, other products. But the way I viewed it, rightly or wrongly, I remember I did a little side project years and years ago where I had my own little business. I was doing, you know, design services, ticketing and posters and things like that, you know, as a little side project, as you do over the years. And I remember dealing with a customer where they were looking to spin up an IT suite. It was a council-run initiative where it was giving back technology to, you know, young kids and, you know, sort of underprivileged families. So they've got sort of IT infrastructure they could go and use. And I just started working in IT, in business IT. And the guy that was running that at the time turned around and said, I'm going to build all this platform up as a Linux platform. I'm going to get this, that, and the other in there. And I remember having a conversation with him back then thinking, well, I get that. And this is nothing against the Linux community at all. You know, I'm not poo-pooing that. But in the business world, and specifically when you go into enterprise and business, everything is Microsoft, generally speaking. Right. You know, more often than not, it's all, you know, you've got Windows PCs, you've got Microsoft Office on those PCs, rightly or wrongly. And I'm certainly not going to argue about the pros and cons between open source, you know, sort of Office, you know.
Yeah, that's a conversation for another day.
Exactly. But so I kind of said to this guy, it's like, well, don't you want to, you know, I appreciate there's costs involved, but at the time, Microsoft would still offer SKUs and lower priced offerings for, you know, that community kind of licensing and things like that. But I thought, well, don't you want to be given access to IT technology that is actually going to be, I suppose, give more benefit to those people using it? In other words, they can go out and work in other businesses or go and more or less be guaranteed that they'll be working with, you know, at the time, what was it, Windows XP, right. You know, operating system on a client or using Office 95 or Office 2000, whatever, you know, building up that Microsoft ecosystem. And again, there's always arguments, pros and cons for every approach. But I kind of took the track of, and I think generally this is the way I see Microsoft, is that they're that Goliath of a company where they will release products, and they certainly had a bad rap back in the day, you know, that decade ago, where they'd release products, arguably half-baked products, products without certain features that, you know, other vendors had a, you know, I'm doing the inverted commas sign, a superior offering in that particular space. But Microsoft do that, then they build on it and build on it and build on it. And all of a sudden, Microsoft is the de facto. Microsoft is the main player in that space. And I think for my career, I kind of pinned my view on, I'm going to stick with Microsoft purely because they always seem to do the same thing over and over again. And it kind of happened with Teams. You know, I remember when OCS came out and I first installed OCS, you know, I had, you know, the telephony company at the time, we had a big Mitel SX2000 digital telephony system in the company that I was working for at the time. And we were trying to put OCS in to do some voicemail. You know, I think it was OCS 2007 R2. See how I remember those product names even. And, you know, it was one of those things where you had the telephony engineers going, oh, well, this will never take off. This is, you know, this doesn't give you half the functionality. And it's like, yeah, okay. By the time, well, 2007 R2, and then when it transitioned to Link 2010, all of a sudden, I think the telecoms industry was kind of starting to wake up a little bit to, hang on a minute, this voice over IP malarkey, Microsoft are doing this unified comms platform where you can chat and you can call and, you know, escalate to a video call, and you still had that split of a traditional telephony system that was there, and you know, this big black box of servers stuck in the corner of your IT room that nobody shall touch other than the telecoms guy. And you look where we are today, you know, that transition that Microsoft have done, it's been a decade path, really, well, longer than a decade, but with the release of Teams, and certainly under the last year with COVID, and you see how it's gone with Teams, that it's exploded. You know, you've got this telephony aspect, and now all of a sudden, you know, it's not about that PSTN number anymore. It's about that, you know, UPN or the SIP URI, as it's called, you know, that email address looking format thing that we use to communicate with each other now, you know. And And I think that took the telecom, and it has, and it still is taking the telecoms industry by storm. So lots of places are playing catch up. And obviously I work for one of the biggest telecoms providers in the UK, BT. And so that's probably why I've stuck with Microsoft more than anything, because I've, rightly or wrongly, you know, AWS, GCP, absolutely. I've dabbled. I've looked into certain feature sets and functionality. And yeah, absolutely. They've got fantastic products and they've got fantastic functionality and feature sets in there. But I think for me to try and learn to the level of depth that I've had to learn as your, I felt I'd be taken away from one side of the fence or the other. So I've made that conscious decision to try and stay Azure focused now, but I'm not ruling out the fact that I may dabble in AWS and GCP in the future. You know, you never know what's around the corner. But yeah, so hopefully that makes a bit of sense, Alex.
No, it does. It does. So I have a love-hate relationship with Microsoft. When I was in college or in university, because we don't in the United States we do have college and we have the university system, but college is usually like a negative connotation. It usually implies that you don't really know what you're doing yet, right? And you're kind of just figuring life out, and you're usually just doing what we call general education, which is like your English, your history, your science again.
Sure.
Basically a repeat of high school. And then the university is where you're like specializing in your trade, right?
Yeah.
And what you're going to be learning. So when I was in, I guess, university, even though I went to my school still had college in it, I was a Microsoft student representative on campus. So every campus across America would get a representative that we worked for a third party that then worked for for Microsoft. And so one of my favorite things and one of the reasons why I got into the Microsoft technologies was just from a student's perspective, Microsoft gave it all away, right? Mm. So I had access to TFS. I had access to Windows Server. Every XNA, if you remember XNA from way back in the day, right? SQL Server, everything that Microsoft, their entire product suite, all the students across the country would have completely free, untapped access to all their tools and training material. So perspective, it's one of the reasons why I know the technology.
Mm. Oh, no, absolutely. I think that was, I mean, look, the big providers all do it. I mean, Google is the same with Google Docs. You know, I know certainly in the UK, I'm assuming it's very similar in the US, but Microsoft and Google, they both give away so much, you know, for educational purposes and to schools and primary schools. And I mean, it's great. It's absolutely fantastic to see. And I think that more is needed and more can be done with it. But yeah, I guess, at some point, I mean, maybe there will be a de facto. Maybe, you know, I think we're in this realm at the moment where there's so much going on. There's so much innovation and technology features and things that are being launched and, you know, and around the security space. Let's not, you know, kind of, I know your podcast.
Yeah, we're going to switch right into that right now. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's great to see that there's loads of this stuff available to everybody. But, you know, the big boys know what they're doing. They're hooking the youngsters in early so that they know that they're going to go through their career and carry on using the products and become another one of me, you know, yeah, effectively. But, yeah, so I get that completely.
Okay. Yeah, let's transition a little bit to cybersecurity. I wanted to talk about a couple of things, but I wanted to start with just talking about your experience or your thought process of, you mentioned at the beginning that part of your role and your responsibility is helping companies go from this on-prem life that they're accustomed to over to this cloud life that can be scary, unknown, right? Mm-hmm. What are your what are the conversations around security and cybersecurity that you're having with these companies? Is it a concern for them? Is it something that you guys talk about upfront, or is it just not something that people are even worried about?
Yeah, brilliant question. And I think you know the answer already. And I think to put it in perspective from my point of view, so as a, you know, if I coming from a unified comms consultancy background, did I know about security? Yeah. Was I a security consultant? No. So I knew, I say this a lot, but I knew enough to be dangerous. You know, I think is the terminology I would use, is that Of course, I could find my way around security. Was I up to date? Did I know that the cutting edge and the cutting edge methodologies and concepts in order to properly end-to-end secure an enterprise? Back then, no, is probably the best answer. You know, yes, I could do a bit with firewalling and this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. But the point is with Microsoft now and where we've got to is security, absolutely 100%, is up front and center in every communication that we have. And it's quite a strange position because, you know, I've got colleagues within BT that I talk to who work in cybersecurity, not from a Microsoft point of view, still looking at this traditional, you know, sort of firewalling and network security and maybe delving into the application security. But when you look at Microsoft's product offerings and the way that they've matured and grown over the years, Microsoft's security standpoint and their product offerings are absolutely vast. Now, if you're going to ask me to compare like for like products, I probably wouldn't be the best person to say whether this is good or not. But cast your mind back to the point that I made earlier about Microsoft being that kind of company, that Goliath of a company that will release a product, and before you know it, they're overtaking those other vendors in terms of capability and feature sets and functionality. I mean, one of the things that you can look at, which is probably a good takeaway, is Microsoft have got this thing called the Cybersecurity Reference Architecture. I'm just trying to see if I can find a URL. But if you go to, I think it's aka.ms/MCRA, which is, the Cybersecurity Reference Architecture from Microsoft. And that is, if you like, I mean, if you call it up on your screen now and for your viewers, if they look at it, you know, at some point, but you can see there's a slide deck in there that the capabilities, and effectively it'll show you from a technology point of view what capabilities Microsoft or what SKUs and what products and services they offer. And it goes, so if you imagine from that traditional viewpoint of cybersecurity, you know, physical security now, when we're moving customers into the cloud, as much as it is still there, and it's absolutely still a requirement from the point of view of, you know, if you've got stuff on-prem, a lot of that is taken care of when you move stuff into the data center. You know, you're kind of buying those physical security requirements from Microsoft in order that you're housing your data. So, and especially with things like Microsoft 365, all of a sudden, your security now is decentralized. It's no longer about that perimeter around your network and your physical data center on-prem.
And that's interesting to me. And I want to hear your perspective. I understand mm-hmm. it's probably not your domain, but that to me is the part that scares me the most, right? Because mm-hmm. When I look at least American cybersecurity and what we're expecting and what our government expects from companies, right? It's your end-to-end, you're responsible for the whole thing, right? Because one of the biggest concerns, I've worked in defense and with defense contractors, right? So you're talking military contracts my whole career is, you need to and must and are held accountable for every access to the box where the data is at. And so the second you take the data out of your on-prem and you move it somewhere else, how do you manage who's got access to that box? And and how do you now like entrust these third-party companies to have that same level of rigor and accountability that you are entrusted by as the owner of that data?
Absolutely. And I think that was the, I remember those questions were difficult to answer like sort of 4 or 5 years ago. They were difficult in the sense that people weren't really getting this whole concept of cloud. But where we're at today, so Microsoft they got websites. So they got the Trust Center, they got the Service Trust Portal, they've got these things that answer those high-level questions, you know, mm-hmm. what are Microsoft doing in order to protect that data? And without going into it in too much detail, but you imagine a Microsoft data center, you know, actually getting access to that data center for Microsoft employees is like Fort Knox at the end of the day. So the actual physical access to get somebody into that data center, they there's so many hoops and they are time bound. They've got very specific tasks that needs to be done for anybody. And look, they don't get in. If they've not got a reason to be there, nobody gets in. And, you know, it's got all the bells and whistles, you know, as you can imagine from a, you know, Mission Impossible.
Probably, Tom Cruise. At that point, what you're describing is probably even better what the defense contractors are doing with their data centers. Because I've been to the data centers for defense contractors and it wasn't Fort Knox.
And you know what? And this is the point. And this is exactly the point. From my perspective, I think a lot of the security, so if you imagine as a consultant, I get to speak to a lot of good security teams that work for businesses at the moment. And look, if they've not broadened their horizons in terms of had the chance to look and develop and understand cloud technologies and cloud security and see how far it's come, to say it frankly, you're right, Alex. I think more often than not, moving your data to the cloud is probably, you're going to get a far better security posture than actually trying to manage it yourself on-prem. You know, you are a small team. You've maybe got a few contractors that you use to manage, I don't know, your firewalls or your routing infrastructure, whatever it may be. But how can you compete with the economies of scale of Microsoft and the whole ecosystem that they've built into their data centers? You know, and AWS and GCP, you know, absolutely. So that's the conversation now today. I think a lot more people are starting to feel, do you know what? Actually, we can probably do far more and we can tick a lot more boxes from a compliance and regulatory posture actually by moving to the cloud now, rather than having audits and security audits being on-prem. You know, if you're trying to get ISO 27001, which is, you know, one of the security, cybersecurity kind of accreditations in terms of regulatory compliance, you know, the amount of effort you've got to go to kind of prove and check and understand that you've catered for every single one of these controls and metrics and points. Look, Microsoft have got it all. You've got a document say, yeah, I'm moving my data to Azure. More often than not, they are compliant with that standard. But look, that's not an easy answer to say, yeah, just move your data to Azure and you're golden.
Yeah.
You know, there's absolutely that shared responsibility model with your cloud provider, you know?
Yeah, it's super interesting to me, though, because, again, it's just from like a cultural thing and just from a third party thing, right? I've never worked for Microsoft. I've only ever heard stories of just tech in general, right? You just generalize it to Amazon, Apple, Google, just all the big tech companies. And I just remember, like, from day one, the rules that I've had to follow as a cleared employee, right? The restrictions, the things that you're not allowed to say, able to have your phone with you, right? Not able to even talk about work, able to do any of those things. But then you hear from like the Microsoft culture of openness and just collaboration and innovation and everything, just so much more willy-nilly. That's the part that kind of just, I've been more scared, because to me, in my mind, right, and it's just like my lack of perspective, it's I've seen that world of terror of like what these defense contractors have to do to go above and beyond to protect the data and the incentives and the fear that they've put on their employees versus maybe not so much fear and not so much restriction. So it's great to hear that, at least from that perspective, at least Microsoft is thinking about it and is actively managing it. I just think me not ever having worked there, it'd be great to like see it more, where I would maybe feel a little bit more comfortable. If I wanted a government contract, I'm signing an agreement with the government saying I'm protecting this data, even if I have to stand in front of a bullet, right? And I just don't see that coming from these third-party providers like Amazon and Google and Microsoft, where like, are they also on the line for the same level of accountability then?
Yeah, well, I it's like I just mentioned then, Alex. I think in terms of the cloud providers, you can go, I think it's Trust. I don't quote me on the URL, but I think it's trust.microsoft.com. That gives you that ability to see the accreditations and what the compliancy, the industry, the regional, the vast amount of different compliance and standards that different countries have to conform to. Now, I'm pretty sure Microsoft have got, I don't know, all of them. But, I think at that high level, if you need a platform that needs to conform to some kind of compliance or regulatory body, you can go to that website and you can get that information that you need and you can dig into as much detail.
I think this is great. Yeah, because again, it's just when you go to a Microsoft building, you're invited, right? It feels like a warm, fuzzy place where you just want to be there. You almost want to live there. Right.
Yeah.
If I were to bring
free
you
free drinks, they got Xboxes in the foyer. It's all great.
If I were to bring you to a defense contractor, you'd think you're walking into a penitentiary or something.
Yeah. Like, oh, don't get me wrong, Alex. Yeah. I think working at BT, you know, I've had my, because, you know, being a consultant architect, you know, I've got the relevant security clearances that I need to work on, you know, various government projects within the UK, and I'm with you. You walk into those buildings, it's literally, you know, leave your phone at reception, you know, you literally got a pen and paper, cover up your webcams, you know, all that kind of stuff. And
a lot of paranoia. And
absolutely, well yeah, and it's right, let's face it, there's absolutely, it's right to have that kind of paranoia. But I think when it comes to choosing your cloud platform, it's not that there's a one-size-fits-all solution by a long shot. I think it's only recently that you know, things like government and MOD defense type projects have kind of started to warm to cloud technologies, if I'm being, from my, you know, my narrow perspective. Right. You know, I'm sure it's been a lot longer than that. But I mean, you see now, what did Microsoft win 6 months or so ago? They won the biggest deal for the Pentagon.
I forgot what it was called, but yeah, that big cloud contract.
Huge contract.
Amazon was really upset about.
No, absolutely. And look, I think it's like anything. People take time to kind of change their viewpoint on things. And look, I mean, one of the things that Microsoft are doing from a security point of view is that, like I said earlier, over the years, it's been that consultants like myself, where you're dealing at the application level or specific functions or features, have kind of become this pseudo security consultant, because look, we've had to configure identity management, we've had to configure, you know, lots of these different features like conditional access and multi-factor authentication from an identity point of view, and then you know, we're putting stuff into Azure, so we have to spin up VNets, we have to put either network security groups or Azure firewalls or front doors or, you know, application gateways and, you know, all of these kind of things. And like I say, if you look at that reference architecture, it looks very busy when you build it, but it's got pretty much every single product and its position in terms of where it sits. And one of the big things that Microsoft have done now in terms of identity is effectively becoming the key holder to security. Yeah. Everything is hinged off your identity. So when you log on to something, your identity is the master key. Now, things like, you know, we know passwords are a problem. We know passwords have been a problem for a number of years. So, you know, look, we've got multi-factor authentication. We've got things like Windows Hello for Business that now all of a sudden it can take facial recognition. You know, we know we've got pins, we've got smart cards, we've got, you know, two-factor tokens, we've got all sorts. And we've now got this passwordless concept now, you know. So using things like YubiKeys and biometrics and passwordless technologies.
I can't even get into my Outlook anymore without having the app authentication.
Yeah, I'm the same. Well, you can imagine the number of accounts I've got. Every time I log on to something, I get pop-ups on my phone, and I try and keep the same way of logging on. But
with this, though, I kind of want to briefly talk about something, right? Look, so we're becoming so dependent on that multi-factor authentication, with a good majority coming in through our phones, right? What worries me, too, then, is like phone companies and other entities, right, not necessarily in the technology space, not coming up to speed, right? So I've had instances where I've heard instances where influencers or people that are in the public domain get their phones hacked. Not physically getting their phones hacked, but somebody calls like Verizon on their behalf as an imposter, and Verizon security policies are so lax that they'll happily transfer the account over to that fake phone, and all of a sudden all your authentications are not going to that fake phone. So it's like, I'm worried a little bit, because I think everybody needs to start doing their part to help protect the world.
Hasn't it been the case for a long time that the people have become the weak link in the security, well, in any chain? It's always the flesh and bones is the weak link. You know, I think that whole social engineering, look, I think that's going to play a part for a long time. And you know, end user education, which, you know, if you work for any large business, certainly from my point of view, I get, you know, every year I've got to sit through, you know, how to spot a phishing email, how to spot social engineering, those kind of things. Just like you say, that awareness that these things do happen, but, you know, be aware of them. Make sure you don't facilitate in these, you know, even tailgaters in buildings, you know, stopping people and asking for their badge and not holding the door open through a lock controlled door. these are all kind of, yeah, they're social engineering tricks that hackers and, you know, bad actors are going to try and play to circumvent any of these technology kind of measures that we try and put in place to you know, protect right. our data and our services, aren't they?
Yeah, and the last thing I want to talk about here with cybersecurity is this notion of like chicken and egg. And I think I mentioned it briefly when I was on your show, right? Is in the next 5 to 10 years, as more and more companies adopt the cloud, right? And they entrust more in the cloud. I feel like have you ever seen Fast and the Furious, the 5th one?
Oh, I couldn't tell you which one was which, but I the probably one where have. They were down
in, the one, I think it's the one where they were down in Mexico. And all of the drug lord had these safe houses everywhere, and then all of a sudden, when they attacked one safe house, they centralized all their money into one location, right? Mm. And so I guess the point I'm trying to make here is, with an on-premise architecture, the benefit is it's decentralized, right? I mean, if you're an attacker that needs to go and physically gain access to a building, you're going to be going to a lot of buildings. But now, as we're moving to the cloud, you're kind of centralizing the locations to very strategic, well-known places. Is that a fear or a concern or anything?
I've definitely been party to those conversations, and I've heard conversations about that. And I think, well, look, I'll give you my take on it. I think you're right. I think there is this fear of transitioning, you know, putting all your eggs into one basket. So all of a sudden you've got 100 companies that traditionally would have had their own little mini data centers or broom cupboards right. storing their physical kit. All of a sudden they're lifting all of that up and putting it into one big data center. Yeah, you know, from that point of view, if you're putting everything into one geographical location, then who's to say there couldn't be a targeted attack on that building, and all of a sudden, you know, the attack has just taken 100 companies.
We get those attacks on accident internally, right? We've had at least here in the US, we've had over the last year and a half, we've had events where a developer, I think it was even at Amazon, a developer accidentally hit the semicolon or something on a command and took out the whole western part of the United States is Netflix.
Microsoft have had, you know, I think there's been at least two recent big problems that Microsoft have had that have literally taken Azure AD offline and prevented thousands and thousands of people and businesses logging on. So yeah, you're right. And I think, I mean, the layman's way of looking at this is, as much as you move your data to the cloud, generally speaking, cloud providers like Microsoft and AWS and GCP, they work in regions. And generally speaking, a region has got, you know, two or more facilities that are separated by a reasonable enough amount of space that effectively, if there is a targeted attack on one building, the data and security principles and all that good stuff is kept in at least two of the other data centers. So I think there's general rule of thumb that when you put a piece of data code or data into the cloud, generally speaking, that is then replicated to at least two other locations. Yeah. So you've got three copies.
Or if you're Microsoft, you just put it at the bottom of the ocean.
What was that project? Natick or Natwick, I think. Yeah, that was Atlantic, cool. Right? They did. That was actually just up on the North Sea, just off the coast of Scotland here in the UK. They dropped that test. It was a development. It didn't actually have anything in it as such as production workloads. But I think they did it as a test to see what effect it may have. You know, does it raise the temperature of water? Does it affect any of the habitat of fish or any living things? So that was cool. It's cool to see what they're up to.
I wanted to pick your brain a little bit on, like, do you see any advantages or disadvantages within the world of your domain, right, within the cloud world, of being in Europe versus like the Americas with respect to things like GDPR and rules, regulations, just different policies?
Do you know what? No, I think
ever impact you or your decisions or anything.
Yeah, do you know, it's one of those things that absolutely there are differences. I think, are there differences to the extent that you'd want to choose one region over another? I'm not sure that there are, not in my experience anyway. I think, look, every country and region have got got their own problems. I think it's probably fair to say they've got their own laws and regulations that you have to adhere to. I mean, is there one set that's more prevalent than the other? Now, you look at countries like China, you look at Germany. Now, I know from a Microsoft point of view, those locations are inherently difficult with data anyway. So, it's a case of generally, I think Germany have got their own, don't quote me on this now, but the last time I remember, Germany had their own tenant for 365. You know, if you were a German customer, in other words, their regulatory bodies would absolutely not allow any German company's data to reside on services outside of Germany. So, and it's very similar for China. So I think Microsoft have partnered up with local Chinese authority, government-run bodies that they can offer those services into China. So they've got their own thing. But look, I don't live in Germany. I don't live in China. So I very rarely get to talk or speak or understand what those issues are. But from my point of view, they've probably got their, you know, their own problems over and above. But I think generally speaking, you know, GDPR is a big thing in the UK, obviously. But again, the controls and techniques and mechanisms that you get with a cloud platform help you, certainly from a compliance point of view, and help you conform to those standards and put those checks and measures in place that you can be confidently audited and, you know, be confident that you've got all the relevant controls.
Your cloud provider. Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that's good. And I think we last mentioned, like when we last spoke, that like the United States is doing something similar with this new executive order that our current president signed, mandating that almost every entity in the government's going to have to start leveraging the cloud one way, shape or another. Which is interesting because, again, most of my experience in the defense world, we saw the opposite, right? We saw a curiosity of wanting to investigate and see that shiny object and that shiny toy and kind of want to see what it's all about.
Yeah.
But fundamentally know that it's impossible to even leverage it because of just the rules and implications that are currently in place. So I'm interested to see how laws and expectations will shift over the next few years to encourage more people to go to the cloud.
And remember as well that in terms of things like Azure, it doesn't have to be cloud only. You know, it can be this hybrid approach where, you know, Microsoft have launched a range of products where you've got that capability to have physical infrastructure in a data center of your choice, but you get the management and control planes that you're, you know, that give you all of this rich functionality and feature sets that you get with a platform like Azure. So things like the Azure Stack Hub range of products, the Azure Stack HCI for hyperconverged infrastructure, and then you've got the Azure Stack Edge devices for kind of edge compute capabilities. They're all physical things that you can buy and install in your own prem. So you can go and get an Azure Stack Hub piece of kit, scale that to suit your requirements, and you've effectively got your own private Azure data center wherever you want to put that. So if you are a defense contractor or, you know, a defense body or some government official organization that absolutely cannot, for whatever reason, you know, allow data to move outside the boundaries of your own physical walls, you can do that and still have the benefits of Azure. You know, that is something to keep in mind as well. And effectively, you get the same control mechanisms, the same security principle and concepts that play over all of that stuff that you've got in your Azure Stack Hub or Edge or HCI. Right. But equally, you can hook that up with a cloud subscription or multiple subscriptions where, you know, you can have this hybrid environment where you've got stuff that may not be so important that can go and live in the cloud for whatever reason. There'll be some business objective that you can tick the box for and put some stuff in the cloud. And you can absolutely have those very secretive or, you know, highly confidential or whatever workloads that you have, you know, on your own bits of tin, and you can have this almost seamless single pane of glass way of managing them from a, you know, an admin's perspective as well as a security and operations perspective. So I know one of the big things that's certainly we in BT, we've launched, you know, services around, you know, Security Operations Center using the Microsoft SIEM platform, which is the Azure Sentinel product. I don't know if you've come across that. Yeah, Alex.
No, but after this conversation, you're making me a believer in Azure, and I'm going to go dig deeper. Because I think within my audience, there's been a lot of interest between the two worlds, right? A lot of people are in the cybersecurity, and a lot of people are into the cloud stuff. And I'm finding or discovering that there's so many resources that I really haven't leveraged. And I think it's time for me to start exploring these items more. Because part of my goal has been, I'm going down a solopreneur road of quitting my job and trying to grow my skill set. I've been consulting. I've been freelancing with Jira, which is a project management tool that Atlassian, an Australian company, puts out. And I've been just crushing it with just being deployed to company and helping them adopt the technology and the tool and just helping them really learn how to leverage it. And I'm at this point, like, how do I start leveraging my passion for cybersecurity and then also start leveraging cloud skills that I don't have, but I don't so desperately want now to kind of just start.
Well, do you know what? In answer to that, Alex, one thing I called up, I was going to mention to you on this call now, is that Microsoft have always had exams. Yeah, they've always had learning pathways in order to learn some of this cool technology. Mm-hmm. Azure Sentinel, if you are in that security operations center, the number of connectors that it's got, not just to applications and services in the Microsoft space, but third-party apps, hardware vendors, you know, product vendors, Cisco, NetApp, you know, all of the various security providers across checkpoint firewalls, and you can get connectors that basically pull off the metrics and the signals from those devices straight into Sentinel, and it's a SOAR system. So effectively, then you can use it for that extended detection and response kind of analysis. But it will correlate. So if you get a bad actor comes in through a particular firewall aiming at a particular application, Azure Sentinel is built with machine learning and AI built into the product. So it will help you correlate all the different signals through all the different vendor products for the route that attack has taken place. Mm-hmm. And it will help you create those alerts that then as a security professional, you can go and investigate and see if anything has happened. So
that's a good point, because one of the common problems that we have in our space is most businesses don't take a baseline, right? So this is only beneficial if you know what you're good cases.
Absolutely.
Anomalies. But so many companies wait so far into a deployment, so far into adopting any technology to then take a baseline that by then you almost have garbage in is garbage out.
Well, yeah. Have you already been infiltrated? You know, that's the thing, isn't it?
So you're just masking your infiltration as a baseline.
It looks good to me. But I was going to say, in order to get to know and get a bit more hands-on, Microsoft relatively recently launched a whole new range of examinations. And with those examinations, Microsoft have done an absolutely fantastic job of bringing up their Microsoft Learn platform, where you can pick an examination. So the security exams that I'm talking about now, you've got you might want to write these down, but they're things like the SC900 is like a fundamental exam across compliance and security across both Azure and 365. And that's like you dip your toe in the water. SC900, you know, I sat that exam only a month or so back, you know, just because it was a new exam. But you can dig into the deeper dive ones. So I talked about
How many certs do you have?
Out of curiosity. How many do I have? I think I. Well, do you know what? That's the you see it across all the socials at the moment. I've probably got, I don't know, without checking, I've probably got about 20 current certifications and accreditations. So I've got, I've been doing them for a number of years, and I think they build up. I think if I look at my transcript, I've got about 38, 39 exams that I passed over the years. But what Microsoft have done is they've brought out this new range specifically for people that are in that industry, that part of the IT industry, to learn these new skills using the Microsoft products. So you've got the SC. So if you look for SC900, you've got the SC200, which is the SOC exam. So it's the based on the Azure Sentinel. So that's the security operations analyst. Okay. And then you've got I'm just checking now, SC300, which is all about identity and access. And then I think you've got the 400. So SC400 is all about information protection. And they're kind of four core security-specific exams that overlay previous exams that Microsoft had. So previously, Microsoft just had, based on a security focus, they had the AZ500 exam, which was the Azure security exam, which concentrated on lots of things, Azure AD, network security in the cloud and that kind of stuff. And then they had the MS500. And what I'm seeing now is that they've pulled off elements of those MS and AZ500 exams into these SC exams. So the point I'm trying to make is that if you go and have a look at any of those exams and you get a bit of a feel for, okay, that's the kind of area I feel I want to work in or I want to work with, you just scroll to the bottom of the exam page, and you've got, I mean, I'm just scrolling down one now, so I'm on the SC 400, and I can straight away, I've got three learning paths covering, what, 12, about 15 modules or so, and that's all free content to help you learn these products and services. And there'll be sandbox environments in there. You can spin things up for free, I'm guessing. That's what they normally do. And examples of how you can hook in some of these services and how you can use them. Yeah. Basically, it's they've done a really good job in helping, you know, break down some of those barriers to entry into these technologies.
Okay. Yeah, no, thank you so much. I'm definitely going to check them out. As you're talking, I'm just thinking of new TikTok ideas for how to jump into this. Because I think this is perfect, right? This is exactly what a lot of my audience and community are interested in. Is I get a lot of like high school, college level students where like, I want to get into this space, but I don't know where to even start. So I think I'm going to dig a little deeper, not only for my personal benefit, but again, obviously for my audience to get that. But I know we're here at the end of the hour here, and I just wanted to basically open it up and say, like, where can people find you? What are you working on? Like, how can my audience interact with you or get to know you a little bit better?
Yeah, well, as you know, Alex, I'm more than happy to chat with anyone. I have good fun out there in the community. So I go by the handle Johnny Chips, and that's Johnny Chips with a Z, I think is my tagline now. So if you look me up on Twitter, I'm there. I've got a blog, johnnychips.com. I've got a YouTube channel, Cloud Talk with Johnny Chips, where, like you're doing, Alex, I speak with brilliant people across the industry, you know, both sides of the pond, across Europe, across the US, and other places across the world. I've had the privilege to speak to, I think I'm up to about 28, 29 people now, where I've done talks very similar to this, but with, you know, screen sharing, a bit of bits and pieces. So, yeah, more than happy. Reach out if there's anything I can help with, and I'm more than happy to. You can know where to find me.
Okay. Well, thank you so much again for coming on. I didn't get to everything, so maybe we'll have to do a follow-up maybe at the end of summer or something, and see where we're at.
We'll have another chin wag then. It's a pleasure, Alex. Thanks for having me. Yeah, go on.
Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you feel that someone you know could benefit from listening to this episode, please feel free to share it with them. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to my podcast, and thanks for the support. If you know anybody else, or if you'd like to be on the podcast yourself, feel free to reach out to me. I am looking for other guests for the month of July and August. So if you got something to talk about cybersecurity, I'd love to interview you. I'd love to have you be a part of my podcast. So feel free to reach out. And again, don't forget to share this. I am averaging about 30 downloads an episode. So I think I'm doing really well. Just a few months ago, I was averaging 10. So already a huge improvement there. So yeah, let's get it up to 50 an episode. And I'll see you in the next one. Have a great day.